And welcome back to Midday. I'm Nikki Gamer in for Dan Rodericks. Thanks so much for joining us for the second hour of our show. A walk through a mall in America can tell you where we are today when it comes to women's fashion. Bras that peek through shirts, shapeless dresses, skin-tight pants, teeny tiny shorts. Even in more formal settings like work, women's attire can be ill-fitting at best, too revealing or casual at worst. But it hasn't always been this way. Before there were makeover television shows like What Not to Wear, a group of women called the Dress Doctors were teaching Americans how to look their best at every stage in life. My guest this hour is historian Linda Prevashevsky. And in her new book, The Lost Art of Dress, The Woman Who Once Made America Stylish, she chronicles the history of women's attire in the first half of the 20th century. Armed with simple design principles, the Dress Doctors taught American women from all social and economic classes how to dress in a way that made them feel more confident, and they spearheaded a national movement toward beautiful, economical, and egalitarian fashion. And even though we might be a long way from where we once were when it comes to how we dress, there is hope yet. In fact, Linda Prevashevsky says there's a lot we can learn from the wisdom of the Dress Doctors, and her book is a part call to action toward rethinking the importance of dress in today's society. Linda Prevashevsky is an associate professor of history at the University of Notre Dame. She's also a prize-winning dressmaker, and we're glad to get her on our show today. Linda Prevashevsky, welcome to Midday. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Am I getting your name right?
Yes, you are.
Okay, it's a hard one.
I know.
All right, well, first off, I want you to set the scene for us. Take us back to the turn of 20th century America. What was the style for women at this time?
Well, there had been a movement for some time to try to get women out of really tight corsets, which had created that amazing Victorian hourglass figure. And as the 20th century sort of started, there's a movement away from that, slightly looser corsets, but also lifting skirts off the ground, which was considered quite shocking at the time because then you could see women's ankles and feet. Which, as I said, was not something you ordinarily got to see.
Talk a little bit about where were we as a country. And I know that the Dress Doctors were addressing a need for women at that time.
Well, 1900 and then after, you see the rise of the progressive movement. And these women, whom I call the Dress Doctors, are part of that in a couple of ways. These are people who are very interested in bringing science to Americans, and they thought the government was a good way to do that. So scientists had figured out in the late 19th century how bacteria spread disease. So one of the reasons for getting skirts off the ground was that at this point there were lots of horses in the streets, of course, and when you get the skirts off the ground, you get them out of the horse manure. And that was one way to keep from dragging germs home. So science is one of the ways in which these women wanted to teach changes in dress and encourage them. The other way has to do with art, which really has a very traditional connection to women in the 19th century, because women were considered more spiritual than men, more religious than men in the 19th century, and art was considered a reflection of God's creation. And so the idea was that women were a little more appreciative of art than men, although they didn't sort of extend this to thinking of women as artists, actually, just appreciators of art. And the Dress Doctors wanted to bring what they considered the spiritually elevating and beautifying elements of dress to all Americans. They argued that you can have beauty in dress just as you could have beauty in a wonderful fine painting, but most people can't afford a fine painting. On the other hand, everyone's got to get dressed every day. So this was a really democratic way of bringing art into everyday life.
Now, we're not talking about just women in cities, right? We're talking about women in rural America who really wanted to feel more feminine.
Well, they wanted more beauty in their lives. I mean, that's really clear. The Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture sent out a survey and then published the results in 1914. And there are lots of things you would probably expect, because he was saying, what can we do for farm women? We do a lot for farm men, but what can we do for farm women in particular? And You know, people said things like, well, if you could give us efficient plans for kitchens, right? Good ways to get water into the kitchen, good places, you know, to ways to organize the kitchen so that we save steps. All really practical things. But there were also a number of letters that said things like, we want to know how to beautify our homes and beautify our yards. Tell our congressman not to send us more turnip seeds, tell them to send us flower seeds. And then there were several women who commented about dress. In particular, they said, look, a farm girl wouldn't want to go to the big city if she knew she could be just as beautiful and have just as beautiful a home and just as beautiful clothing as any city girl. So why don't you write pamphlets on that? And so they did.
Now, clothing has always been more about what covers the body, right? It can reflect everything from how much money you have to what community you live in, to gender. And at the turn of the century, at the time you're talking about, it was one of the few areas where women were expected to play a role.
Well, women did play a role in many ways. I mean, obviously, for a lot of rural women in particular, we had the what I call the sweat equity element, which is you could sew your own clothes. And the dress doctors always taught sewing. And actually, the USDA organized clothing clubs for girls and women, 4-H clubs for girls, and they were the most popular clubs that girls and women signed up for. And these were run through what were called extension programs. We would think of them as public outreach programs that came out of the land-grant colleges. So sewing was one of the ways in which women could create their very own clothing and make it beautiful. And that's why they wanted to teach them the principles of art so they could apply them to their clothing. The other way is that if you think of these professional women as creating a kind of niche for themselves, some of them worked in retail, the School of Retailing, which no longer exists. It was folded into the School of Business at New York University, for example, produced several important textbooks came out of that program that was designed to teach both those who would make it up to being buyers in retail, right, the people who decide what's going to be in the department store, but also to teach clerks how to put together a beautiful ensemble for someone who is going to come in and buy it. So retailing was a space when it came to clothing that women could find professional work and could sort of work their way up the ladder into good paying jobs.
Now let's get to the focal point of your book, the so-called dress doctors, which I love the name. As I understand it, they're not a formalized group. Who were these women?
Well, they're not, and that's my name. I made that up. It's based on a story that I call her the grandmother of all dress doctors. Mary Brooks Pickin was born in Kansas on a little farm, and she learned to sew and weave by the time she was 5 years old, which is just remarkable, and then went on to teach sewing in Kansas. And it's a great range of people, from the young women of the at the YWCA to the women prisoners at Leavenworth Penitentiary, which I always think sounds like a rather scary thing to be doing, teaching them how to sew because of the sewing shears and all that. And she told a story of a young woman physician who came to her and said, look, I don't understand clothing and I don't really want to, but if you could tell me how I could dress, if you could look me over and prescribe a wardrobe to me, then I will wear it. And I want you to do that for me. And she did do it. And the doctor reported that other doctors at the hospital treated her with more respect than they had before, that the nurses at the hospital also treated her with more respect, and that people who had never before bothered to consult her professionally now did so. So it was this remarkable transformation where she was in effect cured of her problem with clothing, and that's why I call them the dress doctors. But you're right that they weren't all doing the same thing, and they didn't necessarily all know one another. There were women like Mary Brooks Pickin who often worked independently and did a lot of writing. She wrote an enormous number of books and pamphlets that other people came to rely upon. Then there were women at the land-grant colleges who ran these extension programs. There's a pair of sisters who actually taught at the University of Minnesota. They taught art and decorative art, and they, the Goldstein sisters, Harriet and Veta Goldstein, and they wrote a book called Art in Everyday Life, which became incredibly influential. It came out in four editions, starting in the 20s, running through the 1950s. And I don't think there is a textbook on clothing and textiles that comes out after that that doesn't borrow from that book. And then, as I said, I mentioned earlier, there's a group who works in retail and wrote books that were very thick, actually, rather impressive books that were designed to teach buyers and clerks, sales clerks. They didn't all know each other, but they all shared a lot of ideas. They clearly referenced each other's books and used each other's books, and they had this enormous influence. They literally, millions of girls took in home economics courses these lessons on dress and sewing.
Yeah, let's talk about home economics, because that was the one class in middle school that I just could not master. And I even,
oh dear.
I'm sorry to say, I can barely sew on a button. So tell me, you know, was this something new at that time to teach women, you know, in a classroom, this type of lesson?
Yes. Home economics has its start in the 19th century, but it was really focusing at the land-grant colleges. So it's at the college level. And if you think of the 19th century as this world in which men are given most of the public world and women are given mostly the domestic world, it sort of makes sense that then there would be women who would say, well, let's bring all of knowledge to bear on that domestic world and make of it, you know, as good a world as we can, as, you know, to inform women and to tell them, you know, what are the best ways to do things in their home. So home economics, and if I showed you the textbooks from the 30s, for example, you would be floored by the number of things that were covered in these home economics textbooks. Obviously dress, which is what I'm talking about, but also infant care, budgeting for the home, home decoration, etc. All of these topics would have been, including family relations, would have been covered in home economics classes at that point in time. And the idea was, okay, women, I mean, think of it this way. These women found a professional niche for themselves as home economists, but they knew that most women at the time were not going to be working outside the home and were not going to become, you know, professional businesswomen like themselves. So they argue what we need to do is to train them for what they're going to do, which is to be what they called at that time home women as opposed to business women. So by the 1930s, 90% of junior high school girls had home economics course required.
Wow.
As a required course, and 90% of the towns in America that were big enough to have their schools were requiring it as well. So it's an enormous group of young women who would have been reading these lessons.
Now, something that came as such a surprise to me is this idea of the early, I want to say, fashionistas as really pragmatic and emphasizing thrift, right? You know, you think of fashionistas today or the women who are setting style trends as highfalutin, have lots of money, but these dress doctors, they emphasized knowledge over money.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of ways in which fashion magazines today are really different than what they taught. They argued that, and again, it's part of their democratic impulse coming out of this sort of progressive era ideas of the first couple of decades of the 20th century. They argued that what makes clothing beautiful is knowledge, not money. You don't need a huge wardrobe. In fact, Mary Brooks Pickin told a story about a woman who had exactly one dress that she wore every day to work for 2 years. And, you know, when they worked out these budgets and other things, they were very keenly aware that most people don't have an unlimited amount of money. But they always argued it didn't matter if you took the principles of art, and they were drawing on the Western tradition of European art. If you take those principles and apply them to dress in the ways we're going to teach you, you don't have to worry about having a big wardrobe, because that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is to have beautiful clothing.
I love that. I want to hear about those principles of art. It's time for a break here. More on women's fashion and the dress doctors with historian Linda Linda, you say it.
Prevashevsky.
Linda Prevashevsky, author of The Lost Art of Dress, when we return. And I want to get our listeners into this conversation. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you'd like to know why certain styles have disappeared, or maybe you'd like fashion advice straight out of the pages of history, give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. More when we come back. Stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Nikki Gamer, in for Dan Rodericks, and I'm speaking with historian Linda Prevashevsky, author of The Lost Art of Dress, The Women Who Once Made America Stylish. Linda, before the break, we were talking about artistic principles that guided these dress doctors. Let's lay them out for our listeners.
Okay, well, the dress doctors drew on the Western tradition of art from Europe, and also on some ideas from the arts and crafts movement, which began in Britain in the 19th century and then had an American version as well. You've probably seen, you know, Stickley furniture, for example. That was one expression of arts and crafts in the United States. And they took the principles which were used in teaching art composition, right? How do you decide how a painting or a sketch should be put together? And then they applied them, changed them a little bit, and applied them to dress. And obviously one of the greatest differences between art and clothing is that clothing has to move, whereas art mostly just sits there, right? So the principles were five that they came up with, which was harmony, rhythm, proportion, emphasis, and of course, now
balance.
Yes, balance. See, you read the book. Good. So those are the five principles. And, you know, for example, for harmony, the one that I start with, because I think it's the most important to them too, was harmony of shape, which holds that clothing should not hamper a healthy human body in motion, right? You should be able to walk, for example, which is why they didn't really think a lot of very high heels with very pointy toes, nor did they think a lot of really tight skirts. And their favorite bad example from the 1910s was the hobble skirt, which was very narrow around the ankles and literally made it impossible to walk freely and gracefully. So that's one of the principles.
And they championed the skirt, right?
What, the hobble?
They championed that free-flowing, that idea of the free-flowing skirt.
Right. And actually, this is what's so fascinating. It's not until the 1950s that the straight skirt even becomes something anybody wears. Prior to that, when you read the design books, and some of them wrote really beautiful and fascinating to me as a dressmaker, dress design books, how basically to become a designer and how to get certain effects from cloth. Until the 1950s, no one even explained how to draw a straight skirt because it didn't make any sense to them. They said, well, obviously when you walk, your legs go farther apart than your hips, right? I mean, that's what walking's about. It's about one leg going forward and the other leg going forward. So nobody actually taught how to make a straight skirt, because they argued that it would lose what they called that graceful swing that you need when you're trying to walk in your skirt.
Now, something that I found was really interesting is that the dress doctors used x-rays to prove to women that their shoes were hurting them.
When I first saw this picture, I just thought it was terrific. It was created by the USDA, and it's got on one side, the pictures in the book, a foot with a healthy, what they called a healthy toe box, which is kind of rounded, and all the toes are like, you know, naturally aligned. And then the other side has this really pointy-toed shoe x-ray, and you can see all the sad little bones in the toes are all crushed and squinched on top of each other. And underneath this little picture, they had the motto, toe room means toe health.
Wow. It's crazy to me to to think that the dress doctors, they weren't championing the shoe. You know, women today, we're obsessed with shoes. I know so many women who have more than 10 pairs and they don't even blink to spend $100 on a pair of shoes that they like. But the dress doctors weren't so into shoes.
Well, they really weren't. And I think, you know, one thing is the principle of art emphasis. They use that to argue you want to bring emphasis to the face. So it would have made no sense to them that the most interesting thing in your outfit would be your shoes, because why would you want people staring at your shoes when you actually want them paying attention to who you are and listening to what you're saying? I have a theory that shoes have become our outlet for our frivolous impulses because we no longer wear hats.
Yes, I was right. going to ask you about the hat. You have so many beautiful pictures in your book that in one of them, the first picture is of these two beautiful women and they're wearing these enormous hats with colored flowers on them. And I thought to myself, yeah. That's an image that's just so elegant. But we don't see hats unless you're going to a special event or to church.
Yes. And that picture's from 1909, and that hats got about as big as they could get at that point in time, and they were really lush-looking. They were quite amazing. And women wore hats. I mean, hats, you weren't considered fully dressed, really, unless you had a hat on, until up to the 1960s. And, you know, there were all kinds of hats. There were the what they called the casual felts. And the dress doctors would budget. In their budgets, there was always a line for hats. You know, you're going to need a new casual felt like every year because you wear that almost every day. And those are hats essentially to keep, you know, the sun out of your eyes, to keep your hair from blowing around in the wind, to keep your head covered. And that was, you know, considered a normal part of every woman's wardrobe. And then in the late 50s, we start to see the rise, literally, the rise of gigantic hairdos that will then, you know, turn into the beehive and the haystack and all these other enormous hairdos. And the hair was teased and puffed up and, you know, lacquered. And there was no way you could put a hat on that without squishing it. And so the young women who opted for these very new and trendy hairdos stopped wearing hats, which meant that the only people left wearing hats were older women and eventually just really old women. And so hats came to be seen as unfashionable.
Should we bring them back?
Oh, I actually think it would be a lot of fun to do that. I took a group of my students in one of my seminars on fashion to make hats, to actually make fascinators, you know, the little cocktail hats.
Oh, I love those.
Yes, yes. So we spent the day doing this. They had tons of fun, and it was very funny because one of them said to me then, "Can we wear our hats?" And I looked at her and I said, "Well, of course, they're hats. You know, you can put them on." And she said, "No, no, no. Can we go somewhere?" And I realized she needed to go with other people, right? You can't. It's considered so odd to wear a hat that for, you know, this 19-year-old college woman to go by herself to an outing wearing a hat would make her feel very self-conscious. But, you know, when we all went out to dinner together, we all wore hats and they had a really wonderful time doing it.
Linda, I have so many questions for you, but I definitely want to get our listeners into this conversation.
Okay.
All right. And I'd like to tell them, if you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you would like fashion advice out of the pages of history, please do give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We have Leah from Odenton holding for you. Leah?
Hi.
Hi. What's your question or comment?
I'm calling actually to ask about home economics. And currently, a lot of colleges and universities are cutting those programs out of their curriculum, but we're still teaching them in the schools. So from my experience, there are a lot of unskilled people teaching those courses in our schools, which seems to be
unskilled in what way?
Unskilled that they're getting certified in it by taking an exam, but they haven't gone to a university and taken the courses.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Okay. Linda, do you maybe have a comment for Leah?
Right. Well, first of all, I would say because of the way school districts work, probably the rules for what somebody needs to be certified to actually teach a given topic are different everywhere. Right. So that would be hard for me to talk about generally. I mean, historically, home economics first started being caught in the 1970s because of fear of stereotypes, right? Oh, all girls are not going to be domestic. They shouldn't be domestic. And as a result, the number of majors in teaching home economics, which was a field of study and is still a field of study at some colleges, dropped in half over the course of the 1970s. And, you know, a lot of ambitious young women went into other fields of study as a result. And, you know, funding was cut for home economics generally. It's teaching in the 1970s. And to tell you the truth, when I think of the course that I took in junior high versus these textbooks that I've read from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, I mean, it's so clear home economics class got, you know, slimmed down to this tiny little fraction of what used to be taught. And I think that's still the case in most places, that it is a very small topic. It's usually not treated in great depth in a lot of places, which may be why, as Leah was pointing out, that some districts might be accepting teachers who don't have a great deal of background in the field.
I want to ask you about something that I found profound in your book. This idea of aging gracefully, right? Before the 1960s, a woman's age proved she was experienced and sophisticated, and now it seems women want to dress like teenagers for as long as possible. So can you talk about how the dress doctors address the aging woman?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things they always make clear, and we really should make it clear. I mean, even in the 19-teens, Mary Brooks Pickens said, women, when you're 45, would you please stop trying to dress like you're 18? So it's not as though this has not been a perpetual problem. But the thing that really struck me is exactly what you said and what I talk about in the book, which was that the dress doctors assumed, and it makes perfect sense as professional women teaching at universities, right? It was very obvious to them that you do become more knowledgeable as you age. Yes, we slow down, but we also calm down, which oftentimes gives us a little greater wisdom, a little greater knowledge of the world, a little greater sophistication. And actually, more sophisticated clothing, which would include what is called draped dress, i.e. clothing that's not cut in a tailored way, but is actually cut with a kind of flow of fabric, was that kind of clothing, that kind of dress design was reserved for the woman over 30. And the argument was only a sophisticated woman who knows what she's about, who's able to handle this kind of clothing, both physically, because there's more fabric. You can't run around in it like a maniac because it needs a graceful kind of carriage to carry it off. Only she can wear these things. They're also, in many ways, the draped dress, and these weren't bare, but they were more revealing of the form of the body simply because of the way that the fabric flowed over the body. The idea was, you know, until you're old enough, you really shouldn't be getting too much attention from men because you won't be able to handle it.
I want to ask, how have modern designers, right, and our countless fashion magazines encouraged this idea of looking forever young?
Yeah, and that really starts in the 1960s. I mean, it's fascinating. If you think about the new look, right, 1947, Christian Dior comes out with this post-war very luxurious look, which has, yes, an uncomfortably pinched waist from I think any angle, that's absolutely clear, but very full skirts and soft shoulders. And the argument was that this kind of a look is actually for the older woman, the woman at least 30 years old, because, I mean, all that fabric, right, all that drapery, it takes a sort of grace that comes with being over 30 to be able to handle it. So the models of the 1950s actually worked until their 30s and 40s. And then, bam, we get the youth quake in the 1960s, and we get people like Twiggy, who was literally a teenager when she starts modeling. But she's not just being shown in teenage fashion magazines like 17 or something. She's being shown in Vogue, right, for adult women. And here is this incredibly underweight teenager. And suddenly we're all supposed to look like that, which is kind of strange when you think about it. And although they got sort of bigger and taller in some ways, the models in the 1970s, it's very clear you kind of moved away from that more womanly figure and that more sophisticated look into something that is just, the whole idea is to look young all the time. I think one of the reasons why the dress doctors found that easy to cope with is they taught college women or high school girls, right? And you can really love the energy and the enthusiasm and the intelligence of really young people and still know that they can be pretty silly too. And they obviously don't know as much, you know, as a professional, which is why I think in their field in particular, it was sort of easy to say, well, it's, you know, when you're young, there are certain fashions you can wear that are, you know, they should make sure that you can move really quickly because that's the way you're going to move. But when you're older, then you can wear the more sophisticated styles. And girls before the 1960s looked forward, right, to being old enough to wear the styles that women wore. And unfortunately, I think today we've been, ever since the 1960s, it's just sort of, you need to look as young as possible, no matter what.
Or as sexy as possible. I think we should talk sexiness, right? And this whole idea of dressing to impress the opposite sex or someone you want to be sexual with versus the dress doctors eschewed that idea.
Yeah, they considered any woman who dressed simply to gain the attention of men to be a slightly deranged, I think would be a word to say it. They just, to them, it was just so ridiculous. I mean, why would you organize your entire life around trying to get the sexual attention of men? I mean, there's so many other things we have to do in a given day outside of seducing anyone. And it has really, now on the one hand, clearly fashions have changed, right? There was a point where just sleeveless dresses alone were shocking. Realize this in the 19-teens. But at the same time, I'm struck by over time how, as I was thinking about it the other day, I said, why are we so naked? The men aren't naked.
We are.
Boys aren't naked, right? Boys aren't wearing leggings in high school. I think if they wore leggings in high school, people would be like appalled. And yet that's what all these young, you know, these girls in high school are wearing. So why is it that we feel compelled to expose as much flesh and form every day? One of my theories is it's pop singers, the influence of pop singers, which I think a lot of young people really look up to and know a lot about. And they have been in a sort of contest, you know, to be as overtly sexual as possible.
Right. Well, it's time for another break here. More on women's fashion and the dress doctors with historian Linda Prevashevsky, author of The Lost Art of Dress. When we return, stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Nikki Gamer, in for Dan Rodericks this hour, and I'm speaking with historian Linda Prevashevsky, author of The Lost Art of Dress, The Women Who Once Made America Stylish. I want to get to some modern applications of the dress doctors, but first I want to know what happened to them. Do their ideas seem to be forgotten?
Yes. Well, partly it's the demise of home economics, which actually, not demise, but the downfall in many ways, compared to its sort of heights earlier on. It actually began in the 1950s when university presidents, who were all men, looked around their campuses and thought, well, we need to win the Cold War, and we're not going to do that with costumes and textiles. So why don't we dismantle programs in home economics? And by that time, the deans of the colleges of home economics, who were all women, that was one way in which they created a professional niche for themselves. These were now old women and close to retirement, and places like Teachers College at Columbia University, the University of Chicago, and the University of California at Berkeley all got rid of their home economics departments and sometimes took various parts of them, like the nutrition program in home economics at Berkeley, and gave it over to the food science, where men ran the show. So there is, and that's the other, if we think about this as professionally, these Home economics departments were where all the women scientists were before 1960. Most of them, anyway, were in those departments. So this was a real blow to their power and their prestige. And then during the 1960s, right, the youth quake, the baby boomers, they rebelled against some, you know, really bad rules, rules about race and segregation. But they also rebelled against other rules, like dress rules, which I would argue has some, you know, value in them still. The other thing that happened, which we talked about a little earlier, is that home economics became criticized by the women's movement, especially in the 1970s, because, you know, on the one hand, they were aware that these were women professionals, but then they argued, oh, but they're just trying to make girls domestic. And actually, Robin Morgan, who was a radical feminist in 1972, got invited to the meeting of the American Home Economics Association, and she announced that the best thing that all of her listeners at the annual meeting could do was to quit their jobs. That would be the best thing they could do for young women. So there was a very hard political attack on them as well. And then funding got cut, as I said. And
I get the women's movement and that want to see women maybe avoid talking about clothes and get serious, right? Let's talk about the growth of the suburbs. Now, I'll drive out to the suburbs and I'll go to Target and you just see women wearing it's across the map, right? So that has to have had something to do with this.
Yes. The suburbs are another one. If the 1950s is where departments of home economics first came under attack, the 1950s is also the growth of suburbia, right? After World War II, the U.S. was so prosperous. There was so much money. People could buy houses who had never been able to buy houses before or expected to. And they did it in suburbia. Now, the traditional line in clothing was between city and country. City was formal wear. Country was informal wear. They didn't actually use the word casual that much. And suburbs seemed to fall on the side of informal wear. And once people started spending their entire days in the suburbs, they started wearing more informal clothing, and there was a lot more entertaining outdoors, and anything that happens outdoors, you kind of need more informal clothing, right? You can't wear high heels and chiffon necessarily when you're, you know, doing a barbecue or sitting alongside the pool. So that kind of more casual clothing became, you know, the norm for a lot of people. And so that undercut that clear division between informal and formal clothing.
I want to get to the modern application of some of these ideas. If the dress doctors were around today, what advice would they give to the modern American woman?
I think one of the things they would say is stop buying cheap stuff. Buy something in good quality that is well designed that you can wear day in and day out, and don't just buy something because, oh my gosh, it's 2 for $16.
Right. I was actually going to ask you about that because there's so much distance between who makes our clothing even last year, a clothing factory collapsed in Bangladesh. More than 1,000 people were killed. Should we be thinking more about the ethical implications of what we're wearing?
Well, the most elaborate textbooks really started getting written in the 1930s by the dress doctor. So think about, you know, when that is. It's during the Great Depression. So they actually have units in the book about how to be an ethical shopper. Don't waste the clerk's time, for example, they say. Make sure that there's a union label on your clothing. This is when clothing was still largely made in the United States, because if it has a union label, then you know, right, that it was made under ethical conditions and you can buy it without having to worry about someone being very badly paid for what they're doing. I mean, obviously today with things all pushed overseas, I mean, what's happened is this kind of race to the bottom. Who can find the poorest people in the world to make things as cheaply as possible? That's why, you know, there are some people who make a real point of trying to know who is making the clothing they're buying. But it's very difficult if you're buying from really big retailers, right? Because sometimes it seems that they don't really know what's going on in the factories that they're subcontracting.
So should we get back to making our own clothes?
Well, I think there are a number of people who have actually done that. If you think of the rise of Etsy, if you think of the sort of
do-it-yourself. Yes.
Yes, yes. It's a lot. Yeah, I could waste a lot of time on that website.
It's an online clothing. It's for accessories or really all sort. It's like a online flea market. Yeah.
Yeah. There is vintage stuff, but it's a lot of artisanal stuff. So it's people who make it themselves. Most of it, not all of it, but also the sort of interest in do it yourself. That's come around. I think that Project Runway really showed a lot of young people, oh, you can make things yourself, right? There was an increase in the number of applications to fashion design schools after Project Runway started years ago. And so I do think there's an interest. Now, the one thing I would caution, though, is the dress textures always said, look, if you have got a full-time job or you're a college student, you know, and you also work part-time and you are really, really busy, do not feel you have to sew anything yourself. You just go, you make good decisions when you buy. You buy just a few beautiful pieces that fit the way you spend your hours of your life. But you should not sew if you don't enjoy it.
I love that. It's very European. I know European attitude is have fewer things, but have really quality items.
Right. And that's actually, that's what's so funny. We say it's European, but apparently it was American. I think the 1950s and all of that prosperity really shifted because you can see this in the budgets. They collected data. The dress doctors who were at land-grant universities collected data on what people had in their closets. They did this, over the decades. And by the 1950s, it's clear that young college women had a lot more clothing in their closets than, for example, the same group of young women would have had in the 1930s. So I think that had a lot to do with it. I think today now it has less to do with prosperity and more to do with the fact that design has simplified so far, right? A t-shirt is not difficult to make, that everything's gotten so much cheaper. Now, to the dress doctors, they would look at a t-shirt and say, but it's okay, you've worked out a basic silhouette, but what are you going to do with it? To them, it's not even designed yet.
I love this, that in the 1930s, a magazine wardrobe included 6 essential articles of clothing, and a 2007 Lucky article, Lucky Magazine, a month of clothing was $18,000. That'll tell you something.
Yeah, they used to do this, the month of clothing. They stopped doing it when the recession hit really hard, but it was completely, ridiculous. And that's okay. Fashion magazines in many ways play this role of bringing, some people call it aspirational, but right, they're trying to expose you to a lot of things, and that would be great. But I don't think then they should try to act like they can give you tips for actually building a wardrobe, because we can't spend $18,000 a month on our wardrobe. But I think the difference is today is back then they had fashion magazines too, and they showed a lot of really luxurious goods. But we also had the dress doctors sort of working as a counterweight, saying, yes, some of those things are really tempting, but realize, right, you have to live every day in what you're wearing, and maybe, a display of evening gowns is kind of going to mislead you, because you're not going to spend a lot of hours in an evening gown. Maybe you need a really really terrific day dress that is going to, make you feel good while you go to work.
Well, the dress, something we haven't talked about yet that is important, is that the dress doctors laid out the different places where different types of attire were appropriate, right? There's work, there's play, there are different categories for dress.
Yes. And I think when people talk to me about, why is it, and I've heard this from, business people of various kinds, why is it that people don't know what's appropriate to wear to work? I think it's because they don't get taught. Oh, guess what? There are different kinds of clothing appropriate for different tasks. And that's really the goal, is to dress for the task at hand. What are we here to do? Well, if it is a cocktail party, then we are here to seduce and to be playful and to have fun. But if we're here to work, we shouldn't be distracting people with a lot of bare skin or earrings that, sort of loop all over the place, or for school, they always said, remember, you don't get to wear clothing or bangles or accessories that make noise, right? Because school, they always said, is a workshop. That's where we go to learn, and everyone needs to be able to focus, and you shouldn't be distracting everybody else.
Now, you come at this from a personal angle. You are a dressmaker. You have over 700 dresses. What are you wearing right now? What would you wear to do an interview on public radio?
Oh, what would I wear to do an interview on public radio? Well, I would probably wear a day dress of some kind, or I might wear a suit. I love suits. The 1950s like had so many different kinds of suits. It was mind-boggling. And I should correct you. I'm sorry, but I have over 700 books.
700 books.
Books and dress on sewing. If I had 700 dresses, I think my house might collapse. But I actually would I think it's really sad that when the suit was revived for women at the end of the 1970s, a lot of really wonderful ways of putting a suit together when it came to collar and cuffs and the cut on pockets, etc., had been lost during the 60s and 70s when everything got so simplified. So in the 80s, when we had the sort of the rise of the dress for success movement and more of an emphasis on women making it into the executive suite, we'd actually lost a lot of really wonderful design vocabulary that I think we could recover if we looked at suits from the 30s, 40s, and 50s when they really poured a lot of creative intelligence into designing them.
Well, I want to just thank you so much. You've given me some great insight onto why we wear what we wear, and certainly a lot to think about. We could actually do a whole another hour on the women's suit, because I still have a lot of questions about that. But
okay.
We're about out of time here. Linda Pravashevsky has been my guest this hour. Linda Pravashevsky is an associate professor of history at the University of Notre Dame, and she's the author of The Lost Art of Dress, The Women Who Once Made America Stylish, published by Basic Books. It's out now. Check it out. Linda Pravashevsky, thanks for being on our show today.
And thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, and we'll be looking out. I'll be looking out in the fashion magazines to see if the dress doctor's ideas will come on back.
We can only hope.
We can only hope. All right, everyone. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. I am Nikki Gamer, in for Dan Rodericks. Have a great afternoon.